From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. Fleet Mall says he was a holdover from the 60s, practicing Buddhism and smuggling cocaine at the same time. In 1985, he was indicted on drug running charges and sentenced to 25 years in prison. On today's Fresh Air, Mall tells us about a spiritual life continued behind prison walls and his hospice work with dying inmates. Later, we talk about the greatest storms on Earth with Robert Sheets, the director of the National Hurricane Center. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at some of the new shows that look at humor from a female point of view. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House says Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman has offered his resignation and President Clinton has accepted it. Altman has been heavily criticized by congressional Republicans and Democrats for not telling everything he knew of the Whitewater investigation. There's word that the senior lawyer at Treasury, Jean Hansen, will also leave her post. She had contradicted Altman's congressional testimony as well as that of Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen. Democratic leaders in the House say they're optimistic that members may pass a crime bill by the end of the week. President Clinton met last night with a group of Republicans and says he's willing to make some changes in the $33 billion package. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It's still unclear what changes will be made to the measure. The president and Democratic leaders say they're open to making some spending reductions in order to win over at least 8 lawmakers who voted no last week. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt met with his Democratic colleagues this morning.
I'm upbeat about the crime bill. I think we can get a bill finished this week. I think we are gathering opinion and ideas today. We hope to be able to make a decision today and be able to move toward passage of a bill later this week.
One change to the plan being floated, a 5% cut in crime prevention money with the funds shifted to law enforcement programs. Democrats hope that will attract some Republican votes. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Leaders of Operation Rescue today asked to meet with Attorney General Janet Reno. They charged that a Justice Department task force investigating violence outside abortion clinics is violating the civil rights of anti-abortion protesters. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Operation Rescue says the U.S. Marshals are intimidating protesters by photographing them and recording license numbers. The marshals were stationed at a dozen abortion clinics after a clinic doctor was murdered in Pensacola, Florida in July. Operation Rescue's Patrick Mahoney accused Reno and the Justice Department of listening to only one side.
We have no confidence and no trust in the Clinton administration that an impartial, fair, and unbiased investigation will be done by the Department of Justice in this matter.
A Justice Department spokesman said Reno last talked with anti-abortion leaders in October, and the task force head is willing to meet with them now. I'm Peter Overby in Washington.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says Haiti's human rights situation is unprecedented. He says the country has become a land of harassment, illegal executions, rape, and torture. Boutros-Ghali says the Haitian Army High Command is responsible. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 8.5 points to 3,776. Trading is very heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 6 points at 741. This is NPR. NASA has fixed equipment problems aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour. The countdown toward tomorrow's launch is going well. Forecasters say there is an 80% chance of good weather for the liftoff, which is set for 6:54 Eastern Time tomorrow morning. Endeavour has the most sophisticated space radar, which will be used for environmental study. The radar will examine several sites on the globe during its mission. The 10-day mission is similar to one that was conducted in April. Geologists and biologists want to compare seasonal changes. The state of Minnesota and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota filed suit today against R.J. Reynolds, Philip Morris, and 7 other cigarette manufacturers. They allege violations of antitrust and consumer protection laws. Minnesota Public Radio's Jocelyn Estes reports.
Minnesota Attorney General Hubert Humphrey III and Blue Cross officials accuse cigarette makers of fraud and conspiracy for concealing the danger of products they say the companies knew were harmful. Humphrey says this suit will succeed where others have failed.
The difference between what others have tried and what we are trying is that they have always focused on the dangerousness of the product. We're looking at the conduct of the individuals involved in this process.
This suit asks that cigarette makers be forced to pay for health care for people with smoking-related diseases and to disclose results of research done by tobacco companies. For National Public Radio, I'm Jacqueline Estes in St. Paul, Minnesota.
The remnants of Tropical Storm Beryl are moving eastward. One person has died in a weather-related traffic accident in South Carolina. Officials believe a tornado struck the Virginia town of Martinsville early today. Homes were wrecked, power lines were downed. Two people were slightly hurt. Twisters have hit parts of Georgia and the Carolinas. Federal disaster officials are in Lexington, South Carolina. Yesterday, a tornado there damaged more than 100 homes. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In the early 80s, Fleet Maul was living a split life. He would spend part of the year doing drugs and smuggling cocaine up from Latin America, and the other part of the year he was actively carrying out his practice as a Buddhist. Then in 1985, it all blew apart. He was convicted of drug smuggling and was hit with a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence. At that time, he couldn't imagine how he was going to survive all those years in prison. But Maul has turned his prison experience into a time of spiritual growth. He started group meditation sessions for the prisoners and expanded that into the National Prison Dharma Network. And he, along with some other prisoners, started a hospice program for dying inmates. Maul is one of the healthy inmates incarcerated at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. I spoke with him on the phone yesterday and asked him how he was able to meditate in a prison environment.
I turned myself in May of 1985, and I was incarcerated in a county jail for 7 months during my trial and sentencing, and before I was sent here to the federal prison in Springfield. And the county jail was a really horrific environment, very, very hot, very crowded, extremely noisy and chaotic. It was a very insane environment. But I knew I had to practice. At that point in my life, I mean, I knew things were really on the line at that point. I knew I had to practice, and so I just started doing it. I think there was one particular experience where I was sitting on the upper bunk in this little two-man cell, and there was all kinds of noise and chaos going, three or four TVs going, and people yelling and talking, and I'd been sitting there trying to follow my breath for about 2 hours, and suddenly I noticed that my mind wasn't moving, that all this noise and chaos was not drawing my attention away. I was completely aware of it all, but it was not causing me to be distracted. And even though there were a few thoughts arising here or there, they were not causing me to be distracted either. My mind was just completely clear and unmoving and stable. And that was kind of a profound experience. I had had similar experiences like that in meditation retreats, but to experience that in the midst of all this chaos was quite assuring in a way, and that sort of became the cornerstone of my practice ever since.
Well, I'm curious because in thinking about practicing Buddhism inside of a prison, I'm curious about whether there's something about prison life that is conducive to a contemplative life. And I'm thinking about the fact that you do have some time on your hands. There is a kind of routine, a sameness that's part of the structure. There are few worldly distractions. Have you found that to be true?
You're right, and for that reason, people often compare the idea of being in prison to the idea of being in a monastery. But it only goes so far.
Right.
All those things you said are true. But on the other hand, it's very, very difficult to find a quiet place to do any kind of contemplative practice. And if you want to compare it to a practice environment that is set up for practice where there are few distractions and few worldly responsibilities and a sort of a general routine, those places are designed to encourage mindfulness, paying attention to one's experience. And everyone else in that environment is trying to do that. Here, everyone else is trying to remain as distracted as they possibly can so that they can try not to realize they're here as much of the day as they can. People are generally trying to kill time. And the environment is very noisy and so forth. And there's a tremendous atmosphere of anger and bitterness that's just under the surface with everyone. It's not to say that everybody walks around with a sour expression on their face. People joke and laugh, and there's a lot of black humor, prison humor sort of thing. But at the same time, if you just sort of scratch the surface and ask somebody a few questions, you normally get quite a bit of anger or sadness or grief. And so it's that kind of an atmosphere. But if you have some foundation in awareness training of some kind, then that becomes actually a very rich place to practice, because there's this very intense environment that is kind of in your face all the time, and you're always going to be having some reaction to it. And so if you've trained yourself to be present to your state of mind and to be curious about it, then you're going to immediately notice all the time where your state of mind is at. You're either going to be reacting with tremendous irritation and anger, or if you're in a very clear, open state of mind, you'll react with a sense of humor sometimes, or a sense of curiosity to what is really an environment that would drive most people crazy.
How did you become interested in hospice work?
When I arrived here in December of 1985, this being a medical institution, I was immediately struck by the amount of suffering. Even if you've never been up to one of the hospital wards, out in the yard you see people in wheelchairs. In the halls you see people in wheelchairs. You see people using canes and walkers and crutches. And you see people who are obviously emaciated from cancer and other illnesses. And even though I was obviously very overwhelmed by the experience of having been sentenced to 25 years in prison, I was still immediately struck by that, and it was very helpful in a way for me, because I realized that obviously there were a lot of people that had it much worse than I did. And it just really moved me, and I wanted to find some way to be helpful. The other thing was that this was just about the time when the AIDS crisis or epidemic in this country was beginning to come to the light, and so there was a lot of lot going on in the prison system about that. Among the prison population, the prisoners themselves were very upset and scared, and the prison administrations were trying to figure out how to deal with their HIV positive inmates and with their AIDS patients. And I think in the first year I was here, originally they were at one point anyway, isolating AIDS patients in a special lockdown unit, and they were doing this really more to protect the patients than for any other reason, because there was fear of reprisals from the rest of the inmate population, because the inmate population was just very scared at that point, not thinking very clearly. They hadn't been educated about it. So I was really struck by their plight. I happened to be involved with a service organization at that time, was taking movies around, showing them on hospital wards. And I used to take the projector and the movies over to this AIDS ward and so forth. So I just kind of became concerned about that and started writing to organizations on the outside to try and see what I could find out about maybe being of help in here.
Well, in 91, you founded the National Prison Hospice Association. How did you go about creating or trying to create a humane environment for the dying and the sick inside of a prison?
Mm-hmm. Well, the program here actually begun with the inspiration of another prisoner who himself was a patient, a paraplegic patient. And he was living on a hospital ward, and he just happened to sort of get to know several patients who were dying. I think one was dying of cancer and another of AIDS. And he befriended them and got very close to them and stayed with them through their deaths. And he saw what a tremendous need there was for this. These men were basically dying alone on these hospital wards, and he felt that this was something other people could do. And so he started talking to prison administration about that, and I heard about it and offered to get involved, and eventually this program started in We started training in 1987, but the program actually kicked off in 1988, in January of 88, and we started seeing patients. And basically, what we try to do is be a friend to begin with. In many cases, you become like a surrogate family person, just to be there for the patient so he knows that there's someone who cares. We can't change the physical layout of the prison hospital. We can't immediately change the typical attitudes that exist in a prison setting, but we could be there for the person. We could be a friend to them, and we could they could know that there was somebody that cared about them. And that's really what it was to begin with. It's evolved into more than that now, but to begin with, it was just to be there.
Let me ask you, though, do you think a dying inmate wants anything different from someone else on their deathbed?
Well, what a dying inmate wants is not to be dying in prison. They want out. Universally, they are very, two things. Dying in prison is like some sense of, like an ultimate mark of failure on your life. And I think they almost always see it that way. And so their greatest hope all along is to either somehow survive their illness until they could finish their prison sentence, unless they're looking at a lot of time, or possibly to receive a compassionate early release, which happens in a few cases. And so their biggest thing they want is either to be cured or to be let to go home to die. They don't want to die in prison.
Fleet Maul is an inmate at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Missouri. We'll hear more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fleet Maul. He's an inmate at the federal prison in Springfield, Missouri. Do you find that people want to confess things to you? They want to share, perhaps, secrets of their life?
That's true in some cases. I think the first thing is that they don't want to be alone, and many of them don't want to die alone. And they do have the need to share. Not in all cases. A lot of prisoners have a very strong, developed sense of you don't talk about your business with anyone, and you don't get involved in anybody else's business. That's a very strong ethic of sorts, in prison.
Is that so? You won't be vulnerable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the longer they've been in prison, the more strongly they may have that. On the other hand, there are some who are not particularly affected by that particular idea, and they just really want someone to talk to, and they immediately start sharing all about their life with you. There are others who you'll spend months with, and you'll find very little bit about them. In terms of actually sort of the idea of confessing or wanting to get some things off their chest that they have never told anyone, that happens. I don't think it happens a lot or that it's necessarily the regular thing, but it happens, and certainly we're trained to be ready for that and to try and skillfully be there for them in a way that they feel comfortable doing that if they want to do that, need to do that.
Is it hard to sit with someone and not talk? I know for myself, with friends that have been ill and some even near death, you feel the need to fill up the time with conversation, but sometimes that's not what they want.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that we emphasize in our training of the hospice volunteers here. And it is a difficult thing to learn, but once you do get a feel for that, I think you can, and if you're able to do it with a patient and just be there for them when they've made it clear that they don't really want to talk, they might even turn towards the wall in some cases. And you kind of wonder, well, maybe they want you to leave. And in some cases, you might actually ask that. But if you've gotten to know them better, you may realize, no, I'm not going to ask that because I'm not picking up that signal. I would know if you wanted me to leave. So you just stay and sit with them. And you may sit with them for even a half hour or longer. And you find that you can settle into a very sort of comfortable, peaceful place with them, because maybe this is the one time when they're able to relax. Some of the patients actually, towards the end of their illness, are so afraid of dying or so afraid of dying alone that they can't sleep. They're terrified of going to sleep. They're afraid they'll die in their sleep. And so if you're able to sit with them, sometimes they'll use that time just to sleep. They can actually relax because they know that their friend is sitting there with them.
Have you then been with someone at their death and held their hand or been with them as they have died?
Yes, a number of times. Very profound, humbling experience.
Can you actually see life leave them?
That's a very good question, and it's something I've thought quite deeply about. There's been a few instances where I felt sort of something about that transition, of witnessing that transition. But more often, to tell you the truth, even though you're right there and you're watching, it's just like one moment they're there and the next minute they're not, or the next second they're not. They take that last breath, and suddenly there's no one there. And the finality of that is very, very powerful. And the fact that even though maybe here's this person who's all skin and bones, laying in front of you, just literally all skin and bones. But obviously there's life there. And in fact, sometimes a very powerful experience for me has been that it seems sometimes as the body diminishes and wastes away, it seems you become more aware of the being of that person, which seems somehow larger than what's left of the body. So there's this very much this life there, this being there, and then suddenly just gone.
So has hospice work made you think about your own life and death?
Well, yes, honestly, quite a bit. It puts you very much in touch with your own mortality. Being here in prison and working with men your own age who are dying of cancer or AIDS, you realize it could happen to you at any time, and that's pretty scary, the idea of you could suddenly have a pain somewhere or feel sick and go to the doctor and they run a test and you've got cancer and you realize maybe you're not going to get out of prison either. You know, that's pretty scary. Also, I had one patient. He was an AIDS patient. We'd actually become friends before he was assigned to me as my patient. He had come to the Buddhist meditation group that I sort of coordinate here. And he had actually recovered from a bout of pneumocystis and was quite healthy when he came to the group. And he got very involved in the group over a period of 3 or 4 months, and we became friends. And then, because he was well, he was transferred back out to a regular institution. But later, he became quite ill again, and eventually was brought back here. And I found out he was here. Actually, he asked for me, and I was able to be assigned as his hospice volunteer. And I was with him for the next 6 months through tremendous, tremendous suffering that he went through, just horrible. But at any rate, we had so much similarity in our backgrounds. We'd both been involved in some drug smuggling and drug addiction. He had a son the same age as I did. We just had a lot of similarities in our background. I could identify with him very clearly. And it was very hard for me to remain objective as I was working with him. When he would be talking about, a lot of what he was dealing with was the shame and the grief and the sadness over what he'd done to his son. Basically, and his daughter, his two children, just sort of leaving them, and the legacy he was leaving for them. And as he'd be saying these things to me, it was pretty hard for me to stay focused and be there for him because I was getting flooded with all his own imagery about my own life and my own son. So, yes, this work is very powerful in that way. It puts you in touch with a lot of things, and that's why I feel very fortunate that I have a contemplative practice and with which to deal with a lot of those things.
You talk about your Buddhism helping you cope with certainly the emotions of being in prison and coping with your intellectual challenge of being in prison as well. But does it always work?
Yes, it does, actually.
Really?
Very, very profoundly. And not in terms of managing that or getting away from it. Actually, interestingly enough, I've been kind of watching this over the last couple of years, and people sometimes ask me related questions of whether, you know, it's getting easier to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And And it's not. It's getting harder. Mm-hmm. The experience of being away from my family, especially away from my son. I have an 18-year-old son who's grown up the last 9 years without me. And the experience of all that is becoming even more acute. It comes up at times in this flash of the reality of here I am, and this is my life, and this is what I've done to people, and this is, and I still have what still feels to me like a lot of time to do. It comes up very acutely. But at the same time, because I have the kind of training to stay with that when it comes up, not even as a conscious decision of, oh, I need to stay with this because that'll be good for me, but it's just a natural thing, there seems to be this quality of here's all this acute pain, and but there's some space around that, and it begins to sort of dissolve into that space of some kind of awareness. And out of that, there's this kind of unconditional joy that it gets met with. This combination of, well, there's just the pain, and there's a letting go, and then there's this kind of unconditional joy, which is inexplicable and is something very, very sort of unconditional quality of just being that comes up. And I think that's come out of my retreat practice a lot. I've been fortunate enough to be able to do a 10-day intensive retreat here in my room each year for the last 4 years. And I think especially in the last couple of years that's been happening. So, yes, it, even at the worst moments of being in prison, emotionally, at the times of the worst emotional pain and crisis, my Buddhist training and awareness training kicks in its most powerful way, really.
Well, certainly looking back at what you've been able to accomplish in prison, it almost feels, at least to us listening to you, as if you were given a gift in a way, a chance to really change your life and a chance to develop yourself as a spiritual person. Do you see your imprisonment quite like that?
Yes. Sometimes it's difficult to see it like that. But I do. I actually do. And but there's, you know, there's sometimes when I'm, you know, that feeling comes up that I see it so clearly that way, and I kind of well, come on. You know, prison is terrible. You know, I kind of look at it that way. But looking at it objectively, it has been a tremendous gift in my life. It's actually, it stopped all the craziness. You know, I had this kind of split life going on before I came to prison. There was a lot of good things going on in my life and some very genuine contact with a spiritual discipline. I'd gone back and got a master's degree. And at the same time, I was leading this totally crazy life and doing harm to others and being involved in drugs and drug trafficking, very, very harmful things, which I regret very deeply, doing harm to my family. It was just, and in terms of my lifestyle, I'd spend part of the year in meditation retreats and part of the year running around in this crazy smuggler's lifestyle. So it was all crazy. When I came to prison, all the craziness had to stop. It just stopped dead. And so the rest of it was able to grow and to flower. And it's really been a tremendous gift. And the opportunities I've had in here to get involved in trying to help some people. I think for me, in terms of rehabilitation, the most powerful vehicle, I think, is some combination of a contemplative practice and service, helping others. And I think if we can find ways for prisoners, especially people who've been through a lot of trauma or drug addiction or early family trauma or whatever, just a trauma being in prison, I think that's the most powerful thing they can do.
Fleet Maul, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're very welcome, Marty.
Fleet Maul was sentenced to 25 years in prison for drug smuggling back in 1985. He's an inmate at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, stormy weather. The East Coast is still feeling the after effects of Hurricane Beryl, and Tropical Storm Chris is gaining momentum. We'll talk with hurricane expert Robert Sheets. He's flown through more than 200 hurricanes, all in the name of research. Also, TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at ABC's She TV and Showtime's Attack of the 5'2" Woman, two summer comedy shows that let women take the lead. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has gotten some backing for his crime bill. There's hope that the legislation can finally make it to the floor of the House of Representatives for a final vote. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Some members of the Congressional Black Caucus had voted not to bring the crime bill to the House floor because it didn't contain a provision to let death sentences be challenged on racial grounds. But in a meeting with those members, Mr. Clinton managed to pick up some support from Democrats Charles Rangel of New York and John Lewis of Georgia.
This is an individual decision. I will be voting for the rule and against the bill. John Lewis.
I don't like voting against my president, against my party, against the leadership of the House. I'm going to change my vote, and I'm going to vote for the rule.
But Rangel said that he doubted that Mr. Clinton will pick up any more votes from Black Caucus members. Bill Small at the White House.
Healthcare reform in the House may come after Labor Day. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt says there won't be any real work accomplished until the chamber returns from its Labor Day recess. Democratic leaders also say they cannot move ahead until they get hard numbers on the costs of the different bills. A United Nations report is calling for an increase in the world's availability of birth control. The UN Population Fund report says improving the status of women is key to solving the global population problem. The BBC's James Morgan reports the study is expected to anger the Vatican.
Last weekend, there was a mass demonstration organized by the Catholic Church in the Philippines against alleged Western attempts to impose contraception and abortion. But the report from the UN Population Fund says free and equal access for both men and women to health care, family planning and education isn't only desirable in itself, but is a practical contribution to environmental protection and economic development. It notes that although birth rates have fallen, the increase in the world's population is still nearly 100 million a year, the highest in history. Giving women the chance to control their own fertility is one way of tackling excess population growth and overpopulation, and they must be free from coercion. The report quotes instances of the way women in the developing world are given little or no choice in this area, but this changes as they become better educated.
James Morgan reporting. Thousands of Lesotho residents protested in front of the royal palace today. Soldiers fired on the crowd and four people have been killed. Lesotho is a small mountainous country entirely surrounded by South Africa. The protests started after the king dissolved the elected government. The unrest is the latest in a power struggle that's pitted the monarch against the first democratically elected government in Lesotho in more than 20 years. The king says now that he's done away with the government, Lesotho will be run by an interim council that he appoints. He says he'll soon call for new elections. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow gained, or rather lost, 8 points to close at 3,776. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR. President Clinton has signed legislation that's intended to protect consumers from telemarketing scams. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The new law lets people sue fraudulent telephone sales companies directly if their losses exceed $50,000, something they haven't been able to do before now. Consumer advocates say millions of dollars a year are lost through telephone marketing fraud. The law also gives states more support in their efforts to fight phone sales fraud. It makes it easier for states to file federal court lawsuits against telemarketing firms accused of cheating consumers. Until now, most cases against telemarketing scam artists have been filed in state courts because of federal rules requiring minimum amounts of money be at stake. The measure also gives the Federal Trade Commission, the agency which regulates telemarketing companies, authority to fight credit card laundering. This occurs when a fraudulent telemarketer persuades a merchant to submit the company's sales drafts in the credit card system. Under the law, the FTC is required to adopt rules barring telemarketing companies from calling consumers between 9 p.m. and 8 a.m. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Money Magazine's newest survey says the best place to live in the country is Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, the Triangle area of North Carolina. This is Money's 8th annual survey. The magazine says Raleigh has a strong economy, a cosmopolitan atmosphere, low crime, good health care, and great weather. The rankings are based on criteria from a survey of readers. Other top cities that are good to live in are Provo and Salt Lake City, Utah, and San Jose, California. The bottom spot in the 300-city list is Jackson, Michigan, which is economically depressed. An unpredictable 45,000-acre wildfire in central California has been partially contained by firefighters. Cooler temperatures and calmer winds have helped the crews fight the arson fire. Some evacuated residents are getting to go home, and sections of a major north-south highway that links the state have been reopened. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. We're right in the middle of hurricane season, which starts in June and runs through November. So far this year, Hurricane Alberto blew in over Georgia, killing 31 people. Beryl, which was just downgraded to a tropical depression, dropped heavy rains and set off tornadoes in the southeastern U.S. And Tropical Storm Chris is currently brewing in the Atlantic Ocean. A hurricane, as defined by the National Weather Service, is a tropical cyclone which whips up winds of 74 miles per hour or more. Dr. Robert Sheets is the director of the National Hurricane Center located in Coral Gables, Florida. For 30 years, he's been tracking, analyzing, and preparing the public for the onslaught of hurricanes. Before heading up the National Hurricane Center, Dr. Sheets worked in hurricane research. He flew more than 200 missions gathering data from the inside of hurricanes. He says you encounter a lot of turbulence, but flying through a hurricane is not as bad as most people would think.
What's so dramatic about it, though, is that you start off approaching the storm, nice, calm, smooth flight. Then you come into the first rain band, and you'll get bumped around a little bit, break between the rain bands, and it sort of calms down. But now clouds, you look down at the surface, and you see the ocean, streaky nature of the ocean, green streaks. And then as you get into stronger winds, maybe it turns to foam, and now the turbulence gets a little stronger as you're breaking into the inner rain bands, and then you get to the eye wall, and then you may get some of the severe turbulence, and you hear all this noise. It's very noisy at that stage. Again, all of the rain or ice pellets, whatever, beating on the outside of the airplane. And then, boom, you break through the eye wall, and you're in the eye, and it can be actually spectacular, quite beautiful, quite serene. And I think just the contrast of that, just flying through the eye wall and then breaking into the eye, and it's just smooth and quiet.
And this is this calm that's right in the center of a hurricane.
That's right. In the eye of the hurricane, it's very calm. It's the eye wall that
right.
Where all the strong winds are. It's sort of like a donut, the meat of the donut that surrounds the center of the storm. And that's where the strong part of the hurricane is and where most of the destruction takes place.
Any close calls?
Well, in my own case, about three in the 16 years that had those come close together, I would have quit. But fortunately, the three incidents came far enough apart that the memory was such that you forgot the previous one.
Well, what happened?
And one was the worst one that I was ever on was in Hurricane Gladys in 1969 in the Gulf of Mexico. It really wasn't all that strong of a storm, but the aircraft fell about 4,000 feet in a matter of just a few seconds, and some people that were not strapped in got thrown to the ceiling, and material came through the air and struck one of the people who was seriously injured, and so on until we hit the bottom and sort of eased out of it. We thought that we were going to have major problems with the aircraft, popped some rivets and so on, but we got back, the aircraft was x-rayed, and it did pop rivets and those kind of things, but it flew fairly well.
When you're flying into a hurricane, what exactly are you measuring?
It's primarily what you're measuring is the wind, temperature, pressure, and the moisture content that's there. The structure of the storm, that is, where the eye wall areas, how strong are the updrafts, how large of an area is covered by the rain bands, how hard is it raining. This is based on radar simulations, or not radar simulations, but radar observations. size of those droplets, all these things to try to understand better the dynamics of the hurricane itself.
You've predicted that there will be more hurricanes in the future, that actually the last couple of decades have been relatively quiet. You predict a return to the 40s, 50s, and 60s. What signs do you have which indicate that?
Yeah, I don't know as we have all that great of confidence in those kind of predictions on a decadal basis or on a seasonal basis. We do see cycles of hurricane activity, and certainly in the 40s and 50s, we had a lot more hurricanes that were affecting Florida and the East Coast, particularly strong hurricanes, than we've seen in the last two decades. And so we've watched this cycle. We went for the 40s, for instance, there were about 10 major hurricanes. A major hurricane for us is a Category 3 or stronger, greater than 110 miles per hour. And there were 10 of them in the decade of the 40s that struck the continental United States. Decade of the 50s, there were 8. In the 40s, it was primarily over the Florida peninsula. In the 50s, it was primarily up the East Coast. In the 60s, there were 6. That was primarily in the Gulf Coast. In the 70s, there were 4. Those were all in the Gulf Coast. And in the 80s, there were 5. And we started to see a little shift back, some in the Gulf Coast. And then, of course, we had the Hurricane Hugo on the East Coast, Hurricane Diana. And then in the 90s, we've seen Hurricane Bob and now Hurricane Andrew, and last year Hurricane Amelia. So we're starting to see some of this, Amelia. We're starting to see some of this shift back. And some research by Professor Bill Gray at Colorado State University has indicated that some of this cycle of activity may be associated with the rainfall over the Sahel area in Africa. And that rainfall there goes through about 20 to 25-year cycles of drought or wet phase. And right now we seem to be coming out of that 20 to 25-year drought phase, maybe getting up to near normal this year, or maybe slightly below or slightly above normal. And so if the wet phase returns, there is a very strong correlation between that and major hurricane activity over Florida and the East Coast.
Okay. Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Robert Sheets. He's the director of the National Hurricane Center. We're talking from his office in Coral Gables, Florida. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Robert Sheets. He's director of the National Hurricane Center. Well, it seems that the hurricane problem is becoming a people problem in that so many people have moved along the coastal areas of the United States from Texas on up into New England. What problems do you see then as the director of the National Hurricane Center when it comes to the question of evacuation and notifying the public about an impending hurricane?
Well, it's we've done a lot of very foolish things. Is that we think in terms of the short record of possibilities of hurricanes, and so we develop areas where in the past we've had strong hurricane activity, and we'll certainly have it there in the future, but we forget about that because we had this 20 to 25 year period. And so we just place so many people now in harm's way. And the problem is not only that are we putting people out there, but we're not doing a very good job in the way we construct. First decision is whether or not you're actually going to develop barrier islands, and we've clearly done a lot of development of that. But then even when we build a structure out there, we don't build one that's hurricane resistant, resistant in terms of the wind. We have the flooding problem, the storm surge problem. So it is a people problem, exactly that. And now our evacuation times, because of the large concentrations of people, range greater than 30 hours, maybe 36, 40 hours. New Orleans is somewhere around 70 to 80 hours. And we know we don't have the skill to provide accurate warnings at those long lead times.
Are you saying, too, that as much as there's development along the coast, that there haven't been enough roads built in order to get this mass of people out of harm's way?
Right. right. What happens is the more roads you build, the more you develop. So I get entangled in some of those arguments frequently about a new bridge, a new road, and they say, don't we need a new bridge, a new road to this barrier island because we've got a hurricane evacuation problem? And I say, yes, you do. But don't increase the number of people out there after you put the new bridge and the new road in. So it's sort of a never-ending process. You go ahead and put the new bridge and the new road in, and now just more people go out there, and they're actually worse off than they were when they added the previous road. But you're correct, is that the infrastructure is not kept up with the numbers of people that are out there.
Well, I have a confession to make. I have been along the coast of the Atlantic when a hurricane's blown in, and I've stayed there because that lure of the big angry ocean, I mean, it's very exciting, and for better or for worse, I haven't felt that I was in some kind of danger. Do you understand, though, the lure of wanting to be in a hurricane, or does that seem crazy?
Well, there's a lot of people that have that feeling here in South Florida. Most people had not been through the core of a major hurricane. Along came Hurricane Andrew and even some of the previous hurricanes that may have threatened, and they were almost disappointed that it didn't come because of the excitement that you're talking about there. But not one person that I know of today who lives in South Dade, where the core of Hurricane Andrew, ever wants to go through another hurricane. And I think that's always true. Anytime you've been through the core of a major hurricane, you never want to see another one. So there is that excitement, that lure of the storm that's there. But once you've experienced that big one, you don't want to be near one the next time.
Well, how do you get the public to take a hurricane threat seriously?
Where you've experienced the hurricane, here in South Carolina, where Hurricane Hugo went, in Mississippi, where Hurricane Camille went, some 1969, we don't have a problem with those people. They're not going to be there the next time. Where we have the problem is the new people who come down, but more so the people who've been there 10 to 15 years and have been brushed by a minor storm or just the fringe of a hurricane, and they think they know what a hurricane's all about. So usually the new resident, they're pretty scared about hurricanes. You get some response from them, but it's the ones who've been there a few years and have experienced the fringe of a hurricane, and they sort of influence the new residents, say, well, it's not so bad, and so we'll stay. So the best thing we can do is just through the educational process is to try to bring home to them what happens in a major hurricane. Substitute education for experience. Take the experiences of the people in Hurricane Andrew and Hugo and Camille and some others and say, look, here's what would happen in your community. You really don't want to be there.
Well, let's say someone does stay in their house. Where is the safest place to be, and what are some do's and don'ts?
Okay, a couple of things. One is you've got to get away from the water. That's, again, you're going to have the drowning situation, and I don't care how strong your house is built. If you're going to be below water level, you've got a problem. So you've got to get off of the barrier islands, away from the water. Now, as you're away from those locations, the best thing you can do is to make sure that you have good covers for the windows. My own house here in Hurricane Andrew was in the north eye wall, and many others of our staff, and with good covers on the windows, then the interior of the house was in good shape. Now, if you're in the house away from the water and you still have problems, which a lot of people did, with windows coming out, doors coming off, pieces of roofs coming off, all of those kind of things, the safest place in the house is the same as you would treat it with a tornado. Except down here we don't have basements. So where you go is you go to an interior closet and a bathroom, a small room that's interior, away from the outside walls, away from the windows and doors, and get in that location, maybe put a mattress over you, but just basically ride out the storm in one of those areas.
I noticed that the hurricanes have been named through the year 1999, working ahead, obviously.
Well, what we do is give you a little history of that, is that during World War II, typhoons and hurricanes, and they're the same thing, were frequently named by the soldiers after their sweethearts or wives or girlfriends. And in Australia, they were named after politicians they didn't like.
Is that right?
There were some of those things that took place. And then after World War II, we started off with the old military alphabet because of radio communications down through the various islands, the Abel Baker Charlie kind of an approach. And then about the mid-50s, we found that people were having problems with that because here comes along year. Well, is that like Abel last year or Abel 3 years ago or whatever? And so we found that by naming storms, then people can associate with it. For instance, if you're listening audience, when I say Hurricane Camille, that means something. They don't even have to know that it was the third storm in 1969. So starting in the mid-50s, then storms were named after females. And then primarily due to the women's movement in 1979, and also our parent organization is the Department of Commerce. There was a female Secretary of Commerce at that time. And so we changed in 1979 to alternating male and female names. Now, we came up with six lists of names. And we, in this case, is all of the countries in this hemisphere. We, under the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, we have the Hurricane Committee. I chair that committee, 26 to 27 countries. So in 1979, the six lists of names were put together that represented male and female, alternating male and female, Spanish, English, and French. And then you have to make sure that the name is not obscene in one language or another, and that happens once in a while. So it went before that committee. The list, six lists of names were approved, and those six lists of names are then recycled, rotated every 6 years, except when you have a major hurricane. For instance, Hugo, it was a very major hurricane for the United States, and it was then retired. Any country can request that the name be retired. And when it comes back, it'll be Humberto. And hurricane we just had down here, Andrew, that will be Alex when it comes back, and so on. So that's the way the naming process takes place.
Well, I thank you very much, Robert Sheets, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Sheets is director of the National Hurricane Center in Coral Gables, Florida. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. Linda, I assume the crime bill and the health bill still in the news.
Yeah, the crime bill, the health bill, the health bill, the crime bill. We're going to be taking a look at the standing of the crime bill and the president's efforts, and also the we will take a look at sexual predator laws. Some people want the laws in the crime bill strengthened. On the health front, we have an interview with one of the centrist group now drafting yet another compromise and a report on what the hospital lobby has accomplished. Also, Noah Adams' country music biographies continue with Patsy Cline. We'll talk about the life and the music.
Great. Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, ABC launched a six-week summer series called SheTV. It's a sketch comedy show looking at humor from a female point of view. And this weekend, Showtime presents National Lampoon's Attack of the 5'2" Women, in which Julie Brown satirizes two famous females, Tonya Harding and Lorena Bobbitt, from her point of view. TV critic David Biancooley has seen both shows and is here to talk about them from his point of view.
Let's be honest about this. When it comes to sketch comedy, TV hasn't treated women as well as it's treated men. Almost all the sketch variety shows were headlined by men, except for the brilliant Carol Burnett, who started as a featured player on The Gary Moore Show. And if you start thinking about the women who were able to truly showcase their talents on TV variety shows dominated by men, the list is embarrassingly short. Start with Imogene Coca on your Show of Shows, and Carol Burnett, and then you add Lily Tomlin from Laugh-In, and what's left? In primetime, not much. In late night, there's Saturday Night Live, but even on that show, the men were and remain dominant. Gilda Radner developed tons of classic characters, but who else since then has gotten the same chance? Jan Hooks, maybe, and that's it. This fall, Jan Hooks will co-star with Martin Short on The Martin Short Show, a primetime NBC series that has them playing a husband and wife sketch comedy team. That could be a return to the classic comedy of your Show of Shows, or it could be terrible. I haven't seen it yet. But I have seen SheTV and the new Julie Brown special, and I'm not really impressed by either one. When Julie Brown satirized Madonna on her previous Showtime special, her looks and jokes were equally brilliant. This time, they're equally predictable. The funniest stuff is given to other characters, as when the actress playing Nancy Kerrigan is putting on makeup.
Ow! 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 poked herself in the eye with her mascara wand.
Poor thing.
Or when the actor playing John Wayne Bobbitt regains consciousness after his famous mutilation and grabs the phone to get help.
Oh, hello? Yeah, I'd like to report a missing penis. Not person, penis! I don't know how to spell it, I just know that it's gone!
One problem with both parodies is that they've been done before. The Tanya Nancy story by Comedy Central, in a 5-minute spoof that was much shorter and much better. And Bobbitt by, of all people, Howard Stern, who opened his latest pay-per-view special with a typically tacky reenactment. In this entire full-length special, the only real originality comes when Brown's Lorena Bobbitt, along with her surgically restored husband, reenacts his mutilation for television. Unfortunately, she misunderstands the director's final off-camera stage direction and takes it literally.
And action. Remember, you're angry. You're furious. You've been betrayed and you're temporarily insane. Great, now raise the knife and cut.
As for SheTV, the balance of power is shifted nicely. The company features many more women than men. But too much of the hour is just plain dull. Sketches on life-size Barbie dolls and on Chelsea Clinton show signs of cleverness, but go on too long and don't go anywhere. Linda Cash and Jennifer Coolidge, as the mothers of Beavis and Butthead, are a lot less entertaining than their animated sons.
Beavis got expelled again.
Yeah, Butthead screwed up too.
Did you get a phone call from that school?
Yeah, our kids buried a second grader.
So, they left an air hole.
The principal's an air hole.
I'm not sure whether the cast and writers of SheTV can do better, but I know Julie Brown can. Women deserve better than this. So do men.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Sue Spolin, with Jewel Bracey and Kathy Wolf. Abby Beshkin is our intern. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, caring for the soul of corporate America, we'll meet David White. He brings poetry into corporations in an effort to humanize the workplace. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.